Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're here today to talk about Season 2, Episode 1, titled The North Remembers. What do they remember? Everything?
The fact that they have the, you know, just slights, insults.
Yeah, all of it?
Yeah.
Every single one?
When you murder their leader. Huh. They remember that.
That's a pretty big one. what'd you think of this episode?
I really liked it. You know, like I said, one of the things exciting about revisiting season two is, as we've frequently mentioned, that that's kind of peak Tyrion. And Tyrion is one of my all-time favorite characters. I can't really say it's one of my all-time. It's either all-time or not. All-time favorite character on Game of Thrones.
One of your number one favorite characters.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, John, he's an also favorite. It's like cherry and grape Kool-Aid. He's already, like, him smarming into King's Landing was really entertaining.
It's fantastic, yeah.
And just to display, like, a person who's not had any real power throughout his whole life, like, flexing on people who have shit on him was entertaining. Perhaps ultimately foolhardy in the end, but entertaining in the present.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also, like, continually amazed at how young everyone is. Like, the Stark children are babies. Kit Harington is a baby. Even fucking Ser Davos was noticeably... this Game of Thrones series takes a lot out of you, apparently. It ages you in, like, dog or presidential years. But I really liked it. And it's nice to go back to, like, the slow... build up political intrigues of the earlier seasons of Game of Thrones.
For sure. And I think this is a good setup for season two. It shows us, you know, the Robb Stark is not willing to back down regardless of the stakes here because, you know, regardless of, I guess, the temptation because the stakes are so high.
Right.
For the North. And it shows, you know, a lot of the pressures that I think are going to come into play here that they're setting up with the winter, with this war that's been brewing between the Lannisters and the Starks. And I think it really sets off at a good clip at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, to echo your feedback, I was really amazed at how well they did develop all those threats. Like the fact that Joffrey is a handful, now that he has supreme power. Like, what are those limits? Like, you know, that scene of Cersei being legitimately terrified that she had just slapped her son was really great. The stuff that they established about, you know, Rob pushing forward with his claim and the fact that, like, I really liked the narrative, the visual narrative of the bleeding red star uniting everyone under kind of like one ominous sign. And everyone thinks it means something different. But even, you know, when you're zapping north of the wall, away over the narrow sea to Essos, down to everything revolves around the people looking at this bloody comet in the sky and wondering what it means. And I thought that's really cool. That it really captured something that happens in the books really well, too.
Huh. Okay. Wasn't sure if that was in the books, but
it was indeed.
Okay. Let's start off with the recap. We start with the Hound killing someone at King's Landing in front of a crowd. Looks like it's some kind of, I don't know, gladiatorial duel here, because Joffrey applauds him. And the next match comes up. The guy, this Ser Dontis, I think his name is, he's late, he's drunk. Joffrey decides, I'm going to make him drink wine until he dies. And fortunately for Dontis, Sansa convinces him to make the guy his fool instead, because it'd be more fun to torture him for years and years than kill him in a minute.
Yeah.
Tyrion shows up and he offers condolences for Sansa's father, but she's sticking with the Lannister party line of her father was a traitor and deserved to die. I'm not too thrilled to see that, but what are you going to do? And then
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
And I think Tyrion instantly sees the situation he's in and... appreciates the relative strength that she's showing here.
Yeah.
And then proceeds to lead his procession of these vicious mountain tribesmen past a shock to Joffrey and onlookers. So this is Joffrey's name day. It's essentially his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And he is having people killed for sport to celebrate his name day, which is a very Joffrey thing to do.
For sure. Yeah, and it's nice to see, I guess nice is the word.
Right.
I enjoyed watching the Hound brutalize someone.
Yeah, yeah. He's
a beast.
He's a pleasure to watch go to work. I also thought it was interesting how Sansa still... fairly naive that she, like, you know, she's seen firsthand the cruelty Joffrey is capable of to get to a political end or to do whatever, but she's still shocked that someone would torture a man to death mm-hmm. just for the fuck of it.
Yeah.
You know, not in any legitimate combat, not a chance to defend himself, and to use the Kingsguard, who are supposed to be the bastions, like they are the most courtly of courtly knights in the Seven Kingdoms, and it kind of reveals what a thuggish crew that Joffrey has instituted.
Yeah, you got Meryn Trant and that weasel face guy whose name I can't remember.
Right, and you've got the Hound, who was replaced Ser Barristan, and Jaime's the Lord Commander, but of course he is covered in shit in one of Robb Stark's camps. It's a far cry from the glory days when Ser Duncan Atal was leading things, or even, you know, a few generations back when you had Gerald Hightower.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, even when Ser Barristan, you know, if you think about what life was like under the Mad King, he aided and abetted a lot of this kind of type of shit too. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough position when you're knights, when you're in the King's Guard, if you got a bad king. Doesn't seem like they're that troubled by it.
No, it really doesn't. The Hound is, like you said earlier, sort of sticking up for Sansa here. I don't know exactly what's going on here, but I think the Hound, when he steps in and says, "Oh yeah, it's bad luck to kill someone on your name day, he's using the respect that he just gained by killing someone from Joffrey to kind of get Sansa totally off the hook here.
And the fact that also Joffrey doesn't really know anything about anything, and he's very fragile and afraid to be made to look the fool, so his first instinct is to belittle Sansa and her northern ways, and then when the Hound sticks up for her, it's interesting because the Hound's kind of enigmatic. Like, he's been Joffrey's sword and shield since the day he was born, but we've seen him allow Tyrion to slap the shit out of him last season. Mm-hmm. So, like, is there a softer side to the Hound? Does the Hound just like seeing Joffrey embarrassed in public?
I think everyone likes that.
is there actually some kind of, like, is this a legit thing that's known about the land as a curse, or is he just back in Sansa's play for other reasons? I think it's interesting, and he plays it fairly inscrutable.
He does, yeah.
Because obviously, I don't think even the Hound would think that he could get away with just pantsing Joffrey in public.
No.
It would be super funny to see the rest of the Kingsguard try to lay hands on him, though.
Right.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday, join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So then we move on to Cersei and the council discussing the food supply of their kingdom when they apparently get a raven here, a white raven.
Yeah.
Which means winter is coming.
Winter,
is that right?
Winter right around the corner.
Yeah. Tyrion shows up in the middle of it, and he delivers the news that his father has made him the acting hand. Cersei's pissed, but not as pissed as Tyrion when they discuss how they're losing the war, and he finds out that Cersei lost one of the Stark girls and has maybe the best reaction I've ever seen out of anyone on screen.
Yeah, his reaction to then finding Arya disappearing is... And then he's like, oh, must be hard to be the disappointing child.
Yeah.
Because I've been taking all these slings for years, and now you're getting it.
Yeah, he is really just living it up right now.
Yeah. And I like... It's funny because Cersei obviously knows how to play politics better than Joffrey. Because again, not only is Joffrey stupid, not only is he cruel, but he's also very stupid.
Yeah,
and that type of stupidity, that cocksure stupidity, that's going to almost prevent you from learning a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
But even Cersei, it's like a difference of degree and not necessarily kind, because she's like, you know, there's a lot of serious problems facing the realm. They don't have enough food to survive a long winter, and this summer's been so long that none of the Stark children, and they're, you know, 16 to 18 ish depending, you know, maybe 19 ish depending on what you believe with those books versus the show, they've never seen a winter. So it's interesting to see the Grand Maester Pycelle kind of laugh off that as a pet, you know, that's an old superstition. But you know, maybe there's something true in it, and they've only got 5 years of food, and that's without a war going on. That's without this refugee crisis they've got.
Yeah.
And Cersei's like, oh, throw the peasants out. They need to be in the fields.
Yeah.
Well, okay. half the country is torn by war, that's not necessarily like this. This is the seed. These are the seeds that are being planted. They're obviously going to come to fruition later on. And just like the fact that the realm continues to have the so far poor leadership, like, are these problems ever going to be solved? And also it's a great way to introduce that Tyrion's having fun, but there's a lot of work to be done.
Right. Yeah. And it's not being made any easier by the people who are surrounding him.
I mean, look at the small counts. You got Jonas Slint, who is a fucking weasel.
Yeah, that's his name.
You got Grandmeister Pycelle, who is many things, but a capable advisor, a selfless, advisor he is not. You got Littlefinger, who's a rat. You got Varys, who I like, also a rat. And it's not great. None of it's great.
No, it's not. I want to kind of include this next scene in a point that I want to make. We go over to Winterfell, and the Northerners are complaining to Bran and Maester Luwin about the dilapidated state of their walls. Bran doesn't like the way he's talking about Robb, but Luwin's trying to teach him that listening to people is part of his job. And this is the no pun intended, stark contrast between what's happening at Winterfell and the way they're governing and what's happening at King's Landing and the way Cersei's viewing it. Because she's saying, you know what, fuck the peasants, shut them out, we'll be fine, and all of them will die. Whereas, you know, Maester Luwin is counseling Bran to listen to his people and help them. And, like, that's a uniting force, right? Whereas Cersei is a very much a dividing force.
Right.
And I think it's important. That's what they're trying to set up with the juxtaposition of these scenes.
And, you know, you think about this from last season where Cersei told Joffrey, you know, you'll get to make history be whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
Versus Maester Luwin saying, you might not like what he's saying about Robb, but he's got a point. Mm-hmm. Robb's war is costing the North. You know, this guy sent all of his sons off to war, and he's got nobody to prepare his croft before the winter comes. So,
and those Northerners, like fucking elephants, they never forget a damn thing.
Yeah, they don't forget the stark difference in quality between masonry between the reign of King Aerys and
right?
now. Which is ironic since he talks about them not knowing how to swing hammer, and King Robert is all about swinging hammers.
he sure was.
You think there would be you know, an uptick in the enthusiasm for hammer use throughout the realm,
especially with all the bastards he's got out there.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, get those bastards to work swinging hammers.
Yeah, they're going to be able to swing hammers left, right, and center.
A little too young yet. Okay, we go to Bran, who has a vision.
Gendry. Gendry's already got the hammer down. Just send him up to this guy. He's heading north anyway. Have him set this guy's windmill or whatever straight, and he'll be fine.
There you go. I like that. I approve of it. So Bran has a vision of seeing a comet as a wolf and looking into a pond to see its reflection. And he has Hodor take him out there. And as they go out, Asha and Bran discuss what kind of omen this comet might be. Asha thinks it's a dragon, but Bran says, oh, they've been dead for centuries. And then we get a smash cut, which we'll talk about here in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Anything to say about this scene?
No, I just, again, this is the first sight of the comet,
right.
And, you know, there's a lot of prophetic significance. A lot of people think that comets are bad omens, especially red ones, because, you know, it does kind of look like a bloody scimitar in the sky. Also, there's a lot of prophecies involving, you know, promised princes and heroes that... a bleeding star is one of the things that are supposed to herald this. So it's certainly an interesting omen. It's also, you know, Bran is talking shit about Asha, but Asha's a wildling and they're a little bit closer to nature. And we know for a fact that dragons are now in the world.
Yeah.
So
right.
Is it a casual or a causal relationship? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, so we smash cut over to Essos. It's not really smash cut. It's a nice, elegant cut. You know, they go up to the sky, and they see the comet, and suddenly we're over in Essos, where Dany and her followers are marching through the desert. They're running out of food and water, and then Dany's horse dies. So she decides, I'm going to send three riders in three directions looking for any hope whatsoever. And she gives one of the riders a final send-off, which, if I'm the other two actors, I'm a little pissed, because, look... all three of us are likely going off to our deaths.
It's like, am I a blood rider? Am I not? Come right. on. What the hell? Someone's more blood rider than me?
I don't want this guy to be my stand-in on screen. Come give me a send-off.
You can't give him all speaking lines, and you have to pay him scale.
Yeah. So I guess they're marching through the Red Wastes, I guess is what it's called.
Yeah.
Which is an extended strip of desert.
You got it.
Going across Essos.
You got it.
I
like the comment that... there's a couple other crises here. They're running out of food and water. You'll recall that most of Dany's Khalasar, the strength of Dany's Khalasar, was pilfered last season, and they're kind of left for dead. So she's got the old, sick, the young, a lot of the women, and she's got very few actual strong warriors.
Mm-hmm.
So the other problem she's got is that her dragons won't eat. She can't figure out why. She's got meat. Her brother is a know-nothing idiot. He knew nothing about dragons, her and Jorah have a conversation where he reminds her that she's got to be her people's strength, because if they see her falter, then what are they? They're just going to lay down and die.
What if they see a dragon die, though?
That's the thing. I mean, her mystique is the only thing holding them together.
Yeah.
So if she can't get the dragon, I mean, there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of, like, material and spiritual concern she has here. Also... Mm-hmm. She kind of puts her arm on Jorah and says, but you are my strength. And Jorah's heart skipped three beats.
But then she calls the other guy blood of my blood. I'm all confused.
Well, you know, she's spreading the love around. Do you think Dany is seeing Jorah? I mean, this is dumb. I'm not going to pretend like we're speculating. It's something to speculate about, like
sure,
what kind of relationship that Dany might have.
Mm-hmm.
She's grieving widow. She's been through a lot in the last season.
She's a 12-year-old, and he's like a 40-year-old.
She's got heavy weight on relatively slim shoulders, and yes, all that too. But that's some more warmth than you'd expect from even Red Waste conditions between the two.
Yeah, so I think Jorah is like, I guess, her touchstone back to Westeros, right? Like, he's the only kind of like person from her homeland that she has available to speak to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a lot of where their connection comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Is just that sort of like if you're, you know, an expatriate in another country or something.
Right.
And you go to, you know, expatriate groups and meetups and stuff. So you can have a little taste of your homeland. Like you love living where you are, but
right.
that connection back to your homeland makes a lot of sense.
Right. Like, I've heard a lot of people that live in other, you know, like you said, expatriates, like, it's a distinct pleasure to be able to discuss, like converse in your native tongue.
Right.
Like, you find someone from the old country, and it's like, oh, I mean, it just feels good.
Yeah, for sure. So I think he's that to her right now. Then the Night's Watch arrives at Craster's Keep. Ed describes the incestuous situation there. Craster is marrying all of his daughters, and John wonders what happens to the boys, which I think is a pretty good question.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be your first question.
Maybe the seed is just super strong.
Yeah,
he is bust out. He's got nothing but X chromosomes. He's excuse the wise.
Okay,
master of genetic husbandry. This Craster.
Yeah, something tells me that's not
it. He's a real fucking piece of work, though.
He sure is. Yeah,
I like Ed, like Dolores Ed's. I was born in a place like this, and later on, I fell on hard times.
Oh God,
it's such a great line. There's a lot of little humor embedded in this episode. But
yeah, Sam, I guess apparently Sam's ass broke the sledge.
Yep.
That they were carrying all their stuff on.
Yep.
It's pretty good. So we go inside and Craster's drinking and he gets a look at John and he calls him a pretty girl.
Fair.
Yeah, it's because John's starting to run his mouth and
Gior
makes
you know him how
shut
much
up.
Conditioner you use on your hair, John.
Yeah.
Come on.
It's not zero. So Craster gives Gior some shit about Mance once being a part of the Night's Watch. They give him a bribe of an axe, and he tells him, hey, Mance is gathering a huge army, and he plans to march south because it's the only way to go. Craster decides to let them stay in his barn, and afterward, Gior tells John to learn to follow so that he can lead one day.
Good point, because John's being he's being an asshole here.
Yeah.
Like, he's not taking – I mean, does he think it's any easier for the old bear to put up with this fucking – disgusting crusty Craster's bullshit,
right?
Like, yeah. Does he think he has less pride and morality than John himself? And if John does, he's a fool. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that he struggled with amongst the, you know, his peers at the Night's Watch, and now he's like getting a little chesty with the old bear Gior, and Gior's not going to put up with it. They have a mission. Their mission is not to save all of Craster's wives, and John is fucking things up.
So what is it exactly that they're getting from Craster that they wouldn't get if they decided to off this guy? I get that maybe that's not what the Night's Watch does. Like,
right.
They don't go around murdering people for murdering's sake, but this guy clearly seems like he might deserve it.
I mean, that's kind of like asking why the United States treats like the Middle East and other despotic countries with kid gloves, because it achieves their other political objectives. The Craster is a quote unquote friend to the Night's Watch because he offers them a place, a shelter and food when their rangers are in dire needs, as they frequently are up north, and he offers them information that they otherwise wouldn't have. He's kind of like a double agent. So it is a real politic, pragmatic, and morally questionable tactic to let this guy kind of like operate beneath them, but
sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, and you know the reality is, if they did kill Craster, like, it's probably likely someone else, maybe worse than them, would take your place, and then you're gonna have no friends north of the wall.
Also,
so it's that's one of the things that I think any good-hearted person struggles with, like, what do you do about implacable and intractable evil in the world that you have no power over?
Yeah,
like
reminds me of Professor X's character in Atomic Blonde.
Oh, yeah?
In a way.
Oh,
yeah.
I was like, wait, Patrick Stewart?
Sure. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I guess they couldn't replace him very easily.
Right. I don't know if they established this last year, but this Mance Rayder character they establish as a former Night's Watchman who forsake his vows and sought glory beyond the wall and is now the self-styled King of the North.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I'm sorry, not King of the North. That's Rob.
King of some lake somewhere.
King beyond the wall.
Yeah.
King of Bumfuck Pond. It's probably frozen anyway.
Sounds like he's got a big army amassing, though. So
Yeah.
According to Craster, which I don't know how trustworthy he is. So we go over to Melisandre, the Red Witch, offering sacrifices to the Lord of Light by burning the idols of the Seven. Some old guy objects. I don't know this guy's name.
Master Cresson.
Because obviously he died pretty early on. The Macer Crescent Roll.
looks like he's had a few.
He objects.
Looks like he's buttery and flaky.
He tries to stop her, but not really very hard. And then Stannis takes a burning sword from an idol and concludes the ceremony by stabbing the ground, I guess. I'm not sure what that gesture was all about, but
I think it's supposed to come off as the pathetic show theater that it is.
Okay.
That
worked perfectly.
Because I feel like even in the books, like there's like when you get behind the scene of the thoughts, is like everyone kind of sees like the like you're supposed to feel like maybe because this is King Stannis's introduction. This is Robert's brother who you're quickly.
Oh, shit. Is it really the first time we see him?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean he's like this is the guy like we heard of him when Ned sends the letter last season to Stannis, but we've not met him unlike Renly, and you know we've heard like things talked about, and we're gonna see kind of like the strengths and weaknesses of Stannis in this particular episode, but
yeah,
you know you're supposed to get the idea that like no one thinks this is a good idea, this is deeply uncomfortable and profane to many of them. There's a few true believers. But this Stannis has kind of fallen under the spell of this witch woman, and it's made people like Cressen and Davos really ambivalent. And I thought that was a great line when he kind of gets in Davos's face and says, mm-hmm. you know, loyal service means telling hard truths, and he's just surrounded by fools and fanatics. And Davos says, "What is the truth?" Because
yeah.
I don't think Davos is a godly man. So, like, he might be uncomfortable with the burning of the Faith of the Seven and uncomfortable with Melisandre, but, like, when you want him to back truth of the capital T,
mm-hmm.
it's way too realist for that.
Yeah, and he, you know, shows his hand a little bit more when he's talking about getting the ships and stuff
right.
Later on.
And that's the thing. Like, that shows a lot about Davos, that he... I mean, this is such a great introduction to all these characters because Davos is, you know... like pragmatic with a capital P. He is going to pick his time and place, but he will. You can tell that he definitely hears and understands what mm-hmm. Crescent's trying to say here. And yep. also a lot of backstory about this Azor Ahai figure, which is another messianic figure that's related to and may even be identical to the other prophetic figures, like the prince that was promised and the legendary last hero. And, you know, that Stannis pulling the burning blade is supposed to be proof of his benediction, but, again, fairly unconvincing.
He's wearing pretty thick leather gloves. I don't think he felt a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Okay. So we go inside there, wherever they are.
This is also on Dragonstone.
It is? Okay.
Yeah. This is so Dragonstone is where the Targaryens first came to Westeros mm-hmm. and then proceeded to take over the whole continent. And historically, it's been the seat of the next in line for the throne.
Hmm.
And Stannis is. He is the second in line behind Robert. So the throne is, if it's not Joffrey's, if Joffrey is indeed a bastard, the throne is actually legally his.
Right. Okay, we go inside there, and Stannis is crafting his declaration of, I guess, his right to the throne. Davos tries to convince Stannis to join with someone, anyone, but he's not listening. He thinks he's got magic on his side or something. So Maester Crescent rolls up to Melisandre and tries to poison her during a toast,
nice.
But he ends up dying from the poison while Melisandre stands there and just guzzles the rest in his face without issue. Setting her up as a fairly scary person.
It's
great. That's intimidating.
It's great because it shows that there's some kind of power behind here.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe she's just got, like, the fucking, Dread Pirate Roberts immunity to Iocane powder. But, like, she mm-hmm. is more than just some kind of crazy fanatic.
Yeah.
And I thought that, again... It shows everything about Stannis, how brittle he is, not quick to take offense, and how you can see, like, even if he is a capable military commander and he's tough as nails, like, serving under this guy would be a bummer.
Yeah.
Because he's like, take out Beloved, it's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's a Kingslayer. Oh, but he's Sir, because he's a knight if he's anything else. Like, it's such a great characterization in such a brief
yeah.
amount of time. And you see how he deals in black and white, like, Rob's an usurper. Renly's an usurper. Joffrey's an usurper. They're all going to bend the knee or die. That he sees no gray, and you know those type of people falling in with a religious fanatic could be very, very scary.
Yeah, and I think it kind of pairs him up in a lot of ways with Rob, with what we right. see later on in this episode of Rob, how he is unwilling. You know, he's they're both sort of making their lists of demands. And Rob's are just as stern as anyone else's, especially Stannis.
But reasonable, realistic. Like, he's not asking for dominion of all the Seven Kingdoms. He wants what's his back,
North,
and he
yeah.
wants you to stay the fuck out of the North. And right. then that's, you know, with his three victories and the costly victories they've been there, the costly defeats for the Lannisters. I mean, they lost Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
Again, didn't
maybe
seem
he's
unreasonable.
A notch below
all right.
Stannis as far
all right.
as unreasonable demands.
He's a hell of a lot more inspirational as a king, I think.
Absolutely.
I also like the fact that Melisandre, like, you know, Crescent has this great thing where he's like, oh, I'm going to sacrifice myself because I'm this king's leal advisor. That's my job as a maester. Mm-hmm. I'm going to sacrifice myself to take her out. And she waits long enough to let him know that, yeah, I see what you're doing, buddy. And you've wasted your life. And then drinks the poison anyway.
Shows him that it wouldn't have worked had he done it.
Such
yeah.
a fucking power move,
no,
man.
It's awesome.
For a dead man.
Uh-huh.
Woo. Melisandre, Lady in Red.
Did they get a new maester? Is that the procedure here? Like, old maester dies, new maester steps
they
in?
They will get, yeah, every great house gets a maester.
Okay.
Provided by the Citadel.
Oh, what if they sent one to Renly? And we're like, yep, check that box.
I think they will.
Oh, Stannis would be so pissed.
I think they will because the Citadel is supposed to be neutral. Like all, they advise and consent and communicate and record. They're not supposed to. And now, you know, that's an open question of how serious they actually take that, because you know they're men and they're power hungry like anybody. So, but yeah, I'm certain that Renly will get a maester.
Hmm. Okay.
I mean, he was already the lord of Storm's End, which is the traditional seat of the Baratheon. So he would already have a maester. He'd just take him onto a king.
Cool. Let's move on to Rob. He's visiting Jaime in this makeshift cage that they've got him in. Jaime's talking shit to Rob from a position of not very much power. And then his direwolf comes up and gives him the stare down, and that shuts him up real fast. Rob reveals to Jaime that he knows all about the things Jaime's done, including fathering Joffrey, including shoving his brother out the window.
Oh, because that's the thing. It wasn't just Stannis announcing that he's king. That letter was also putting the Lannisters on blast for having incest babies sitting on the throne.
Yes, it was.
Because he said, I'm not going to make the same mistake Ned did and keep this to myself. So now Rob's got it, and that's the thing. And I love the dynamic here is that Jaime is just taunting this boy that he doesn't respect, and Rob coldly and forcefully puts about that he's insulting himself because this boy has just cleaned your clock, and you're sitting and you're my prisoner, and I'm fucking with you with my direwolf. So now what?
Right. And he also says he's sending peace terms to King's Landing, which we see him writing later. You kind of talked about how he was defeated by a boy, held captive, and perhaps he'll be killed by a boy. I really like this scene a lot.
It's the first time I think we've seen a full-grown direwolf too. If I'm not mistaken, we've seen maybe not because maybe Robin. Yeah, he unleashed Grey Wind in the battle Whispering Woods to get Jaime in the first place. But still, this is a very, very powerful animal.
Yeah,
that you would not want up in your grill.
So next we go back to King's Landing, where Tyrion's getting used to his accommodations as the Hand. He makes a remark about at the end of this scene about this being Ned's bed where he slept. The Hands have not had much luck lately. You had Arryn, who got killed at the beginning of this show, which kind of started Ned off in that direction and Robert to come get him. And then you got Ned, who got his head chopped off as Hand of the King. So good luck, Tyrion.
Yep. And he's also got Shay, which I do not like.
No, I don't. I don't really like Shay either, and I don't know if it's the character or the actress that I don't like. I think it's mostly the character.
I think it's a little bit of both.
I didn't
really like her characterization of Shay.
I just didn't connect with it very much.
Like, if you put in Roz for Shay, she would be 1,000% more likable.
Sure, yeah.
But I just... there's something completely insincere about this. Mm-hmm. It just seems like that for this performance to believe that Tyrion would be deluded enough to think that. Maybe we're just at this point in the story because him bringing Shay to King's Landing is as much about the defiance of his father.
Yeah.
And you're not going to tell me what to do, old man, as it is about like a genuine love or devotion that he has for this woman. But mm-hmm. I think that they need to kind of sell a love story between the two of them. And I never bought it. Like it makes Tyrion seem far more foolish to do that. And that's, you know, honestly, that's part of his character, too. Tyrion has this weakness. He wants to be loved and accepted.
Yeah. I don't know. It's not my favorite scene, so maybe we should move on.
Yeah, let's keep on.
Cersei is asking Littlefinger to help find Arya, and they're kind of taking jabs at each other over their affections. And Littlefinger tries to tell Cersei that knowledge is power, and Cersei demonstrates that in actuality power is power by ordering her men to cut his throat and then changing her mind at the last second. And we can kind of see a kid watching from the background here as this all goes on. It's conspicuous. It's in the center of the frame or the foreground of the frame, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Those are Varys's birds.
Yep.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
I think we're supposed to understand that because Littlefinger we did that last year where he's like suggesting all these people are spies. But I think that, you're supposed to understand that, you know, knowledge is power. Because that's the thing is, like, I feel like Cersei kind of proved Littlefinger's point here.
Right.
By, like, yes, power is power, but if you, like look at it in the hands of Joffrey, mm-hmm. it's also self. Look at it in the hands of the Mad King. It's a self-destructing, consuming power unless it's harnessed.
And I think it's great how they position this, especially with that shot of the little bird at the end, because it's not necessarily about having the power, it's about how you wield it.
Right.
And I think Littlefinger is foolish here to start taking shots at Cersei, who does, in the moment, have the real power. His knowledge is not going to save him if she wants to cut his throat.
You're right.
Varys can be more skillful in his knowledge and stay in the background and hide and use that information.
Yeah, you're right. Bandying words with Cersei and taunting. Like she's taunting him, but what does that cost him? Really nothing. She's there to ask him for a favor.
Yeah.
Which is what you want. You want Cersei to owe you things. And he can't help but get his little dig in because he's a prideful person too. And she nips that shit in the bud.
Yeah. he almost gets his head cut off here.
Yeah.
So
you also go back, you know, Cersei started it. That's not something you should do when you're wanting, you know, to belittle a person you want a favor from. Not exactly a clinic of how to wield power authority all around.
Right. So we go back to Rob writing up his peace terms, and he tells them to the messenger, and then he tells the messenger to ride to King's Landing in the morning. Afterward, Theon takes Rob aside to tell him he needs ships, and he can go to the Iron Islands and get them for him so they can take King's Landing. Catelyn does not like that idea at all. She'd rather trade Jaime for her girls. And Rob decides, we're going to continue fighting, and Catelyn says, I'm going home. Rob says, no, you can't go home. As a matter of fact, you need to go to the Stormlands to convince Renly Baratheon to side with us, even though he's got his own kingly claim and he's also got an army. I'm not sure how they settle that one in the end. I guess Rob gets the north and he gets the throne.
Yeah, I think it's the same offer.
Okay. And she agrees and she says, I'm proud of you, essentially. And there are three demands here. I forget what the first one is.
Release the sisters, return my father's bones and the bones of the Northmen, and then renounce claim to the North.
Yep.
The King of the North.
Which I think all of those are acceptable, to Cersei if she could hold on to all of the kingdom. That third one, though, is the real deal breaker.
Yeah.
And they know it. And everybody, like when he says it, everybody looks over and is like, yeah.
That's the one. But I mean, that's the thing. Like, I think that it would be interesting to see, because the only one that's ever been able to conquer the North has been Aegon, and he flew there with dragons after he had he literally melted Harrenhal, the strongest fortress in the entire kingdom. So good luck getting past the Neck and the treacherous swamps and the shitty weather and fighting the North on their own terms. So I think that's why I said it doesn't seem like an unreasonable demand, especially in light of the outrageous conduct that the Lannister Baratheon axis has been displaying of late under the leadership of King Joffrey.
I still feel like it's a bit early for them to say, okay, yeah, we want peace. I think Tywin is a more stubborn. I don't think there's any chance that Tywin would agree to this.
Right. And also, you're right, and that's right.
At this point.
Jaime said as much. You don't know my father, and he's like, well, he's starting to know me. And he's also making the same mistake that a lot of people make in negotiations, which is ask for literally what you need. Uh-huh. Like, if you're going to, like you should have made a couple more even more outrageous. Like, I also want, you know, the Riverlands and the Eyrie, because they've been bros with us for generations and we're intermarried and all that kind of stuff. And then Cersei can be like, or Tywin, and be like, well, fine, you can have the North, and like, deal. You know, if you ask for just what you want, then the art of negotiation is compromise. So you're already going to have to compromise on something you don't want. What, are you going to let him keep your father's bones and mount it like some kind of freakish elephant man exhibit in King's Landing?
You can keep the skull up on the spike.
Right.
That's fine.
Right.
We just want his femur.
Yeah.
And I think Rob knows this, and Rob fully intends for this to simply be a message that says we're not backing down.
Right.
More of like a, just this annoyance to them,
right?
That they're being defeated in battle, and this guy is sending demands. It's more provocation,
right?
So the throne room is getting a remodel, courtesy of Joffrey. He's pulling down all the flowers. He hates flowers, I guess.
Joff's problem. He's just a frustrated interior designer and fashionista.
Yeah,
he's got the soul of like a Tim Gunn.
Maybe,
like,
so.
A Kanye West.
Maybe that'd mellow him out a little bit.
But he doesn't want to act soft, so he's got to act hard all the time, like you know, Tim Gunn. But yeah, it's because I think this is a recurring funny thing to observe about Joffrey. Mm-hmm. Look at the stuff, the details he sweats. It's always about his clothes.
Yeah.
It's about the look of his throne room. It's about he loves this shit.
Yeah,
he loves this shit.
I feel like. In another life, he and Sansa would have gotten along. She's very concerned with, you know, the finer things and the appearances.
Right.
And so is Joffrey. It's just they display in very different ways.
Like if Joffrey hadn't started, because like Sansa was willing to throw her sister completely under the bus and her family under the bus. You're right. If Joff hadn't started things off by literally murdering her father and causing her entire family to go to war with him, I could see her like just like rolling her eyes at his obsession with death and stuff, but kind of rolling with it.
Yeah.
I mean, she still had the underlying, like, you know, one of the reasons she still had this obsession with, like, you know, his courtliness and chivalry and knights and all this stuff that I'm sure Joffrey would have offended. But it might have taken a lot longer. Maybe they would settle into a more Robert and Cersei kind of relationship.
It would have to be another life where he's not this, I don't know, blood lust kind of whiny. I don't know.
It's hard to imagine.
He'd have to be a totally different person,
right,
except for his love of the finer things.
Yeah. No, yeah. She's Sir Loras would be a good match for her.
There you go.
Right.
Perfect. there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
no.
There's no other reason that romance wouldn't work.
Absolutely not. Where was I? Oh yeah. Cersei says that they need to find Arya so they can get Jaime back, but Joffrey isn't that concerned about it. He wonders aloud if he's Jaime's child, but Cersei says, "Oh, that's a dirty lie, spread to undermine your authority." And he presses his luck and he gets slapped for it. And Joffrey says she'll never do that again and then dismisses her.
And you think about that, like, this is just him. But, you know, this obsession turns very dark by the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Which I had forgotten that this, like, shit, all the baby murdering happens in the first episode of season two.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, and, like, the portrayal that that Lena Headey gave Cersei here is that she's legitimately, like, she just realized she stepped on a landmine and heard click.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh man, I got to defuse the situation, or I'm in trouble.
Yeah, and there are a long line of people just waiting to slap Joffrey.
Oh yeah,
and at some point, he's gonna get fed up. And I think if this was anyone else other than his mother, you know, the first few slaps from Tyrion, have pissed him off.
Yeah,
if this was anyone but his mother, they probably would have been dead.
Yeah.
the next person, no matter who it is, might be dead.
Right. And that's the thing, like, it just depends, because, like, I don't know, like, if he would talk a bunch, but he does talk a bunch of shit to the Hound. I mean, he calls him dog and disrespects him, and the Hound lets him get away with it, but it does seem like he saves his toughest talk for people that he can intimidate, like his mother, his, you know, Sansa, little, like, essentially weaker people that have no social or political or physical power.
Yeah.
I would love to see him talk this shit to, like, to Rob Stark's face, unless Rob was in chains.
It's the only power that this kid has is the crown.
Yeah.
Without the crown, what Joffrey is a useless sack of meat.
Right.
Just absolutely detestable in every way.
Yep.
He's lucky that he was born into the house he was born into.
He really is. Although, if he was born in any other house, would he turn out? I mean, that's the whole nature versus nurture thing.
Good question, yeah. So then Littlefinger's whores are learning how to please their clients, both with their bodies and also with their behavior, I guess. And the Kingsguard shows up and kills one of Robert's bastards. Then they go out raiding the rest of the city, doing the same. And they find a man who tells them about Gendry's bull's head helmet, and we see Gendry and Arya riding a wagon down a road.
I believe that's Gendry's former master that he was apprenticing to. That they were holding his face against the forge, Jesus.
Yeah, no, that's right.
It's just a brutal scene. Like, babies getting knifed, teenagers,
getting
little kids being drowned. It's terrible.
Yeah, it sure is.
And they don't, like... You can see how this is, like, just politically unwise because, like, you know, Joffrey's pissing off potentially little, like very powerful people.
Yeah.
And just, you know, what he's doing is morally offensive and repugnant.
Yeah, he's trying to eliminate the threat of more kings, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, this conversation about how many, like, when they're like, you know, he mentioned, you know, our enemies will say anything to delegitimize your claim to the throne. He's like, my claim, and that's this, that his fragility in the shadow of that insult or that threat is leading to this carnage.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do it himself.
No, of course not.
This also echoes, like, Rob saying, I won't need a headsman to swing the sword. I'll do it my own damn self. Where Joffrey's got
the Starks,
these fucking henchmen and these thugs going around doing all this stuff.
And it echoes the other Rob, the Robert Baratheon, Joffrey's presumed father, in that I think he went around and did the same thing with the Targaryens, right?
Right.
After
it's true.
Like, during his rebellion, he just went out and started killing all...
Tywin did it and offered him to Robert as a... like a peace offering. Mm-hmm. Like, I know I was on the wrong side of this, but here's the heirs to the kingdom. They're bashed in brains and whatnot. Which caused a lot of friction between Ned and Robert, as we saw last season. So it is a little bit of like father, like son.
Right.
I mean, a lot of what's wrong with Joffrey, you can lay at the feet of Robert.
Sure.
Like, if Robert had been more Ned, it's, you know, the whole Lannister takeover of the throne might have never happened.
Yeah, I mean,
or if it had, it wouldn't have been catastrophic to the realm.
It's so clear on screen, right? The difference between the Starks and the Lannisters. I mean, it's just
the differences are stark indeed.
They are, and that's the end of the episode. We get a nice little shot of Gendry.
Yep, they're looking for Gendry, and we hopefully see him on the road to the King's Road, heading north to take the Black.
Looking for both of them. Arya and
that's
Gendry.
True.
Yeah,
that's
they're
true. They're
together.
Looking for the Stark Earl and Gendry, and they're all in one package. How convenient for the king. One of the kings. Got a lot of kings in the realm. We got what's our king count? We got Joffrey, we got Stannis, we got Renly, we got Rob.
Uh-huh.
Will someone else throw their crown into the ring? We shall see. And also we got a Khaleesi. We got a queen count. We got four kings, one queen. But she's pretty far off. Pretty far off from doing anything badass.
I thought there were more kings.
Not so far. I mean, there's King Bob Beyond the Wall. There's five kings.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Forgot about him.
Okay. That's the end of the episode. Do we want to do some feedback?
We do. However, I don't have any feedback, any non-spoiler feedback for this episode.
Oh, shit, none?
We do have a lot of spoiler stuff, the majority of it cleaning up stuff that were left over from the most recent season.
Hmm.
So, you know, again, we... that's the thing. It's like, sometimes I feel a little silly doing a podcast where we try to not spoil it, but I do hear a lot. You know, you got to think of some of this is for posterity, that, you know, years from now, people are going to be watching Game of Thrones for the first time, and they're going to be looking for a good podcast. And if our first three seasons of covers is all a bunch of yuck, look at all this crazy stuff that's going to happen,
yeah,
you know, you're sacrificing your future audience. And I think that we can satisfy the spoiler people by you know, having a spoiler section. So,
and I think it's worthwhile to have a non-spoiler podcast simply because, like I said, it fills in the back catalog. But I think we can do a good job of talking about, you know, the episode in the terms of, like, what is developing here.
Right.
You know, and breaking it down and analyzing it, not so much speculation. But
yeah.
I think that's still important for
just
people.
Just talk about the performances and how they're, like I said, I mean, this is, like, as much as last year did a great job introducing so many characters so quickly and so well, this continues in that tradition because, like, all the stuff at Dragonstone is essentially, you know, brand new characters. We're introducing characters that are important to Dany that we, you know, were not main characters last season. We're introducing a lot more of Joffrey and his court. So that's we got this, you know, Craster, and we're getting to know some of the Black Brothers a little bit more. And it all feels kind of effortless.
And I know that my first time through this show, I was very confused.
Mm-hmm.
I was super confused by what was happening in what location, how things that were happening over here affected other things. And I think if I had had a companion podcast that was walking me through it and kind of holding my hand and had, you know, the foreknowledge of these sorts of things, I think it would have really helped me. So hopefully we can be that for other people.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get some more non-spoiler feedback. Maybe not. It's cool if we don't, but it's GameOfThrones@baldmove.com if you'd like to send that stuff in. Again, you can also follow everything we do at baldmove.com and on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @/whatever baldmove.
Mm-hmm.
Not whatever baldmove, just @/baldmove, and you'll get there. So GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. Also have the forums, forums.baldmove.com, if you'd like to comment on as we go through to rewatch. But yeah, now is the time to get out if you are a first-time goer through of Game of Thrones. If you are up on the books and or the series, because at this point the series is beyond the books, I think you're going to be safe in the spoiler section. But everybody else, if this is your first time through Game of Thrones, take off. We'll be here next week with episode 2 of season 2. Before we get on to the feedback and then eventually the spoiler section, I just want to mention that if you're enjoying our Game of Thrones continuing coverage of season 2, our retrospective coverage, know that the only reason we're doing it is because we get paid as for full time to work on Bald Move full time. And the reason we are able to do that is because of our generous listener support. Yes, we do get ads, but we don't get ads frequently enough to make up the difference. And that's where you all come in. And the primary way to do that is by joining the club, club.baldmove.com. If it wasn't for the club, Jim and I would be mopping the sweat from our brow and going back to our full-time jobs. And you probably wouldn't hear from us again until Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Walking Dead would be the next thing you have to look forward to. Imagine that hellish existence. So the club's important, and it's not for nothing that you get a bunch of stuff. You get ad-free feeds, so if you don't like the us hawking mattresses and protein bars and awesome sound systems and all this other stuff, you can eliminate that by paying a little bit a month to support us. You get special audio features if you can't get enough of stuff that we're doing. There's multiple club-only offerings a week. There's access to video feeds where you can watch us record the podcast and other bonus audio and video content. Lots of cool stuff. Check it out. There's the pitch at club.baldmove.com where you can see all the offerings that you get and samples of a lot of that too if you just go to the site to check it out. And free 1 month 30-day trial, so you can kick the tires and see if it's for you. But it is the only way we can produce the amount of content we do, and we thank everyone in advance for their support. For housekeeping, number one, thanks everybody for making the season 7 of Game of Thrones such a success. I wish I'd talked about this last week or even the week 7 of Game of Thrones. But I'll be the first to admit that I'm terrible at every aspect of this job that does not involve speaking into a microphone. So my own self-promotion and marketing. But the reality is our previous 1 week download record for an episode, which is also Game of Thrones season 6, was in the 290,000 range.
Yeah.
And Jim and I, when we were thinking of this season, we're like, there's no way we'll have some kind of 3x growth again. But I'll be damned if we didn't get to a million downloads for a single episode in 1 week for the last two episodes of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. It's insane.
An insane amount of growth. And I know a lot of that is I've seen people sharing our links on social media. I've seen people, like, we always do well when people ask for recommendations in the on the Reddit groups, which are a big drive. You know, a lot of the success that we've had is because you guys have been spreading the word, and I really appreciate that. And I wanted you to kind of take part and pat yourself on the back for that success too.
Can I mention another brief success that we've had?
Yes.
With the pod pack.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're approaching $7,500 on that at this point.
Awesome.
Which exceeded the $5,000 goal that I was hoping to hit. So, yeah, thank you everybody who has contributed to that. You're doing an awesome thing for charity, doing an awesome thing for the podcasters involved, and I really appreciate it.
And like we mentioned, you know, we've got we're dividing it up amongst charity, but we also decided to give our entire share of the proceeds, yeah. Bald Moose share to the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund.
And I mean, at this point, fucking hurricane?
Yeah,
do you support?
I mean, it's like my heart goes out to everyone in Florida and Texas. It's a shit show, and this is going to take over a decade and billions, if not a trillion dollars, to dig ourselves out of. And it's going to be a lot of work, and it begins now. And hopefully our little bit can help out with that.
And it's a little bit. It's like $750
at this
point.
It's spitting
in
the wind of the hurricane. But you know, if everybody did, if everybody that could did a little bit, the load would be a lot lighter. So, you know, if you don't buy the pod pack, maybe you can find it in your heart to help out some people that are in need. Because last I heard, there's like 6 million people in Florida don't have power.
Yeah.
They've gone back to living like 19th century farmers. It's incredible.
And that won't get fixed super soon.
No, it's going to be a long haul. The other thing I want to mention on a much less serious side is I got a lot of feedback about where to find the back episodes, because obviously we have this big sprawling catalog of Game of Thrones. The problem is, for whatever reason, some technical limitation iTunes feed is, once you, if you have a lot of traffic and a million downloads in a week constitutes a lot of traffic, they respond by all those requests on the server by starting to govern how often they update your feed. They're like a self-protective mechanism. So what happens is we'll release the podcast on Tuesday and it won't show up until Thursday afternoon. So what we do during the height of Game of Thrones season is we shrink our episode retention down to fit so iTunes doesn't go berserk and stop updating our podcasts. And we do that throughout the main season of Game of Thrones. I believe you said you relaxed that now. So like all
I
of our catalog.
Just yesterday.
If you update in Game of Thrones either sometime over the next few days, like all of the episodes should be there. Mm-hmm. But also all the episodes I know are on Stitcher. All the episodes are on our website. If you search for the Game of Thrones category and use the previous and next navigation buttons to move around. Yeah. And not for nothing, they're all in the club feed.
Yep.
The ad-free premium feed has all, because it doesn't suffer from the limitations that the iTunes catalog
does.
Yeah,
none of those do.
And that's the thing is, like, it's not just iTunes. The majority of podcast aggregators use the iTunes catalog to populate their discovery system, so it affects a lot of things like that.
You can also avoid that. You can also get faster updates. I'm not sure if people are aware of this, but if you go use the podcast subscription tool on our website and subscribe directly to the feed instead of subscribing through iTunes, you actually end up getting the podcast faster.
Yeah, I've
because
heard that too.
It updates instantly for the RSS feed, whereas iTunes takes a while.
Stuff coming out at Bald Move this week. Seth and I started a coverage of American Horror Story Cult. And it's whacking nuts, man.
Some screenshot. It looks crazy.
It's crazy, and it's a lot of fun. We also have, for club members, we're 1 week behind, but we got our quit your pitching, where we pretend that we're pitching crazy shows to each other. And then we also have Darren Aronofsky's new movie, Mother.
Oh, man.
That looks like it's going to be crazy.
Yeah.
That we're going to do as a first-run Bald movie. That's free for everybody, our spoiler-free thoughts. And then if you're a club member, you get a bonus section at the end where we talk in-depth spoilers. Mm-hmm. So that's what's coming out, a Bald Move. Again, thanks for all your support. Thanks for making us such a huge success. And let's get on with the episode.
We'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
And we're back with the spoiler section. I have some stuff that I wanted to talk about. I think.
Yeah, you want to go first?
Yeah.
So like, let's do dueling plot
okay.
points.
Sounds good. So there's that first scene, you know, where the Hound kills the guy and then Sir Dantas is made the fool. I thought it was really interesting to go back and see how cruelly he was treated and how that kind of toward, you know, the middle of season four, the beginning of season four, early on in season four, he participates in Joffrey's death, which I thought was nice. He's the one who whisks Sansa away. He's the one who gives her, I think, the necklace that she uses to the or that.
No, I thought that. The Lady Olenna gives her a necklace, doesn't she?
No, I thought he met her in like some hedge maze thing and gave it to her.
Maybe.
I'm not certain, though.
I thought
he certainly had a hand to play in it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He was the one that kind of, he was the Uber driver.
Yeah.
that got a dagger in the chest for his tip.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a really cool thing. I also, in that same scene, it's interesting watching Sansa after season 7 because, like, it's hard to be annoyed when you think about how very hard what Sansa is doing to survive.
Yeah.
And just as kind of an impressive as like Arya's lengths to go. It's not as easy to cheer for because she's essentially lying and concealing her true thoughts and trying to use her wits and what little power she has in this court to just stay alive and keep her head because Joffrey is a psychopath. Mm-hmm. Whereas Arya is directly confronting foes and she has, like, you know, relatively powerful allies. You know, Sansa didn't have a recruiter for the Night's Watch, loyal to her father, to snatch her up at a moment and whisk her out of King's Landing. And where would Sansa be if she had?
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting to see, and also like Tyrion when he came in and like the look on his face when she parrots the like, my father was a traitor and my brother's a traitor and I would do nothing against my beloved Joffrey. And he instantly gets all that she's playing her best hand and it's a shitty one.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot more respect for Sansa in retrospect.
Yeah.
Retro respect.
And I think actually my number one favorite thing about watching this episode was seeing the difference in the characters between now and season 6 or 7. Mm. They're totally different people. You look at Tyrion, right?
Yeah.
Tyrion has this carefree attitude about him. He's almost giddy in these scenes at times.
Yeah.
I know he's doing something that he thoroughly enjoys, which is shitting on his sister,
right,
from a position of power.
And flexing. Yeah, yeah.
Right, but I also just notice how good the acting is when I compare the two, because they're very different characters, Cersei included. Like, mm-hmm. Lena Headey does a fantastic job here playing a character who has some power, but only a taste of the power that she really craves.
Right.
And she doesn't have as much power as the character across the table shitting on her.
Yeah,
you know?
And this is peak Cersei, too, because she is finally thrown off the shackles of Robert.
Yeah.
She no longer has to share a bed with him. Her children are on the throne. Her father's off fighting. Other than Jaime being captured, things are really going well for Cersei.
Yeah.
And you're right.
Until Tyrion shows up, I feel like.
And both of those characters, when you look at it in season 7, there's a very haunted quality to them.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're aged and worn, and like even Cersei's not having fun.
No.
This is not the future that she wanted. Great point. I also liked the Tyrion with his niece and nephew, because again, that's something that just came up in the
the old Myrcella.
Before they replaced her, she was supplanted by one younger and more beautiful. I don't think that's true. She's pretty cute, Myrcella, probably younger than the one they replaced her with.
Probably,
anyway,
yeah.
And also those two are BFFs, it seems.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no bad blood between the two. But the fact that he's like, you know, clearly loves his niece and nephew, and they think he's pretty cool too, mm-hmm. other than fucking Joffrey.
Yeah.
But also, you can't help but think Tyrion in hindsight maybe would have done better to go in the King's Landing with a little less swagger.
You think so?
But that's kind of his, he can't help himself. His mouth has got, you know, he's hot-headed and impulsive and rash in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever a great look to come in as new management, slapping people with your dick left and right.
Yeah, certainly Ned didn't do that.
No. So I think, like, I wonder, I mean, Tyrion is doomed because his father's going to eventually come back after the war and he's going to get put back in his place. But also, right. He might have been able to do a lot more short-term good if he had been a little bit less aggressive and more conciliatory. Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe not.
I can agree with that.
And then the other thing is, how many fucking White Ravens has the Citadel sent out in the history of the show? Like, I feel like at least three.
Three rounds?
I honestly couldn't believe it when I first saw it.
It's the three-stage reveal of winter.
Yeah, just for the slow... Yeah,
look, here's one dove, if you're not getting it, or one raven.
We haven't explained this in a while, but Martin has described how he uses his three-step reveal, or he has clues that he intends for the very sharp and perceptive reader, and then one that he pitches for people of kind of like, you know, the average reader would be able to pick up on it. And then the third, he does like beats, you know, like it's the reveal where you just get beat between the eyebrows. So just, he doesn't leave anyone behind.
Yeah.
Citadel subscribes to the same theory. You
right.
tell him once, you tell him what you're going to tell him, and then you tell him what you told him. So that no one's, because I know that like there's this impressive scene in season 6 once they establish the Citadel where you see hundreds of White Ravens flocking, like, oh, winter has finally come. Well, fucking winter came at the start of season 2, you sons of bitches.
All of those are going to King's Landing.
Hashtag fake news. Winter is not here. Ned Stark did not know what he was talking about.
Yep.
Anyway. And then finally, power is power.
Mm.
It's so funny how there's a lot of meditation in this episode and like this whole series, because later on Varys will propound him with the riddle about the sellsword, the lord, and the high septon, and who has the power and all that.
Yeah.
Where does the show come down on power is power? Because even in season 7,
it's tough to tell.
Like, Dany has power because of her dragons and her military might. And before she had that, she didn't have shit.
Yeah.
Rob, before he was able to... Now, I mean, Rob is probably the most, like, pure of a leader because he didn't ask for any of these things. He didn't want any of those things. Although, when Gior put it to him, hey, you want to lead this thing? Rob's like... Or, I mean, John's like, uh-huh. So maybe he protests a bit too much that he doesn't want any of this. But, you know what I'm saying? Like...
Yeah, no, it's still an open question.
Yeah.
And I guess I find myself mostly agreeing with Cersei in this scene.
Yeah, it seems like the show does too, because I thought ultimately the whole point of the parable was the power resides where people think it does.
Yeah.
Which essentially the mass of people is what gives people power, because when they rebel, when they get restless, when they, you know, that then kings tend to get displaced. But the series isn't seeming to support that thesis.
Yeah, and so much of, like, Tywin's philosophy ran, like, directly counter to that, right?
Yeah.
Like, who cares what the people think? They're essentially peasants, and the only people that matter are the lords,
the lion
the nobles.
Does not concern himself with the opinions of sheep.
Right. And we saw what happened to essentially the entire Lannister family at this point, save two of them. So I really don't know where the show is going to finally drop on that, but it seems like power is power.
Yeah. And it's either wielded wisely or unwisely.
Sure. Yeah.
So I thought that's kind of interesting to keep our eye on too. Anything else you want to talk about before we move on to the feedback?
The one thing that I noticed at the end of this Tyrion and Shay scene is their position on the bed. Which is very similar to the way that she dies.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. They're kind of placed head-to-head here, sort of lined up, and we know that...
Better than ass to ass. I've seen Requiem for a Dream. That's a bad scene.
It sure is. Yeah, so when Tyrion chokes her with the necklace or whatever it is, he's kind of hanging off the edge of the bed, and she's laying on the bed, and they're kind of head-to-head there.
Interesting.
Same position.
Interesting foreshadowing.
I don't know if it's foreshadowing or they're just like...
That's season foreshadowing.
That is when that happens.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. End of season 4.
The end, yep.
All right. Well, let's talk about some spoiler feedback. A lot. So we got a couple things that are... One is... the first one's about season 2. Then we have three kind of like meta conversations, and we just get back in this re-educating season 7 and 8, which I imagine will happen for a while.
Yeah.
Lily S., will you guys please do an official count of how many times Daenerys actually says, "Where are my dragons?" It's my personal pet peeve that this is known as the season where Dany just walks around yelling this the whole time. I think she says it twice, and not even until episode 6 or 7. Could you guys also speculate why this is a public perception? Is it from promos or previously on?
Yeah, as someone who's seen... I think it's season 3 of Lost. Mm-hmm. I am immune to people shouting, "Whoa! Where are my dragons?" Like, yeah Michael shouts Walt 600 times in that season.
Yeah.
So you'll never get more egregious than that, and I'm immune to it.
All right. I think it's okay. First of all, last person that challenged me on something like this was Walter Jr. eating breakfasts on Breaking Bad.
And
let me tell
you
what. They did not come off good. We did the count, and it was conclusive. Walter Jr. is the destroyer of breakfasts. we will see if Dany is the screamer of "Where are my dragons?" But I think it's less the factual nature of it than the fans' perceived dissatisfaction of Dany is powerful and she had dragons, and we want her to go back to Westeros and throw her crown into the ring. Mm-hmm. And instead... She's being run around by these fuckers that we don't care about. We know ultimately are not going to be interesting because they're in Essos and the Game of Thrones is being played over on Westeros. So what the fuck? And those fans need to buckle the fuck in because...
Right. Well, here's the problem I have with that is she's not ready.
No. And that,
she's not ready. Her dragons are not ready. She doesn't have the power that she needs to go over there and kick ass.
And I think that's one thing that people that watch the show and read the books eventually appreciate is that if Dany had come... If Dany had some magically had come out of Karth with, you know, army and ships and her dragons large enough to do something, it would have been a disaster because she did not, she doesn't even know what type of queen she wants to be.
Right. Right.
She's starting to, like, she's got the inkling that she, you know, she's like these are my people, the downtrodden, the oppressed. I was down, but she's not fully there. She needs some queen training wheels.
I feel like they would have done well to cast a younger actor, a younger actress for that. If you would cast someone like, she's supposed to be like 11 or something, right? If you would cast
someone,
she's like
13 in the books, I believe.
Like Ari, is it 13?
Yeah. And that's the thing, Rob.
Okay,
Rob's
she's
like,
a little older.
Rob's like 15. I mean, right. All these kids are way young. But yeah, I think that.
But I look at her physical appearance and I say, that's a full grown woman. She should probably have her shit together in season 3 or something.
You're right. Although, really, if she's a 20 year old, would she be ready to? I mean, it's weird, right?
Yeah.
But if they cast Sophie Turner,
but if it was like Lady Mormon or something, right? Like,
sure,
I can get behind that. Okay, she is a young, very young woman. She has lessons to learn. She has things.
But
like,
it'd be super awkward to watch Khal Drogo rail her from behind. In
absolutely,
season 1.
So it would. You can imply it. You don't have to watch it.
I understand why they did the path of aging all these children up because you know Rob soaked in blood and like all the you know it had been weird because. Martin's work is certainly more accurate from a medieval perspective, but it would have been very unpalatable. It's barely palatable for just to read.
Yeah,
you know. But yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. But I think that even from modern sensibility, a 20-year-old woman put in this much power and almost like a divinity that she's got. She's got this mystical aura. Like, there's just no fucking way she'd be ready to lead.
And in no way prepared for it.
No.
She was not given the tools she needed.
And she was never – it was never the plan for Dany to sit on any thrones.
Right.
She was just going to be this Cal sex slave that bought her brother the army so he could go and fuck up the throne because he was a shit too.
Yeah.
I guess, again, in retrospect – it all works out, but I do feel the fan frustrations of like, why is this super cool character doing nothing but getting ripped off and scammed and made fun of, and the things that make her powerful and unique stolen from her, and all she can do, and she has no power. All she can do is bemoan her fate. So I understand. Like I said, it's over. There's no way she says, "Where are my dragons?" like 14 times, maybe more. It got to be more than two.
I don't know.
Because it does seem like it was such a meme that there had to be like 4 or 5 scenes, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Carter Y. Hey, Aaron. Just offering some thoughts on how HBO and the Double Ds could avoid having this climax of this epic series leaked out. We know from this year's production leaks that it's nearly impossible for them to keep everything or anything under wraps, but I propose an alternative solution. Why not leak on purpose? If there are multiple leaks with both truths and lies hidden in each one, we wouldn't know which one to trust as the story progresses. They could even have one, the leak that was promised, that has everything more or less in order, but the final climax twist, whatever coming, is something completely wrong. Obviously, there's some limitations with this. They would be purposely spoiling some of the season's final biggest moments, but it's a sacrifice. Would they be willing to make it?
The Tyrion maneuver?
Yeah.
The canary trap?
Canary in the coal mine. I mean,
canary trap. Yeah.
That's what it's. Yeah, you put out different versions of the truth to see who's the one that's leaking.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I guess if you watch them all, you will have seen the real one, right?
Right.
You won't know which one is going to happen, but you will have had a reaction to it, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do feel like that's still going to be unsatisfying. And the big problem, like Kim and I were talking about in the spoiler podcast we did last week, is the vast majority of Game of Thrones is filmed in outdoor locations that are public places that cannot be effectively closed off. And people with telephoto lenses are going to – I mean, that's the big problem is when the leaks came out last Christmas or two Christmases ago, the reaction was no fucking way. But as they started to film on set and they're like, oh, shit, there's Tyrion and Davos in a boat. And oh, my God, they're rowing off with Gendry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, well, here is they're filming in this giant stone quarry with a frozen lake. Like, people start confirming. And I think people would rapidly figure out what was true and what was not.
So you bring back actors who couldn't possibly come back.
Right.
Like, bring back Catelyn, even if you're not going to do the Stoneheart stuff.
Dressed up
like,
as Lady Stoneheart, just so.
Right.
Yeah. I just don't know what the utility is because
yeah.
you were not going to be able to keep the accurate leaks from happening. You're just putting up chafe and like smoke screen. And I still think it's going to be a bummer if there's like five potential possibilities. And you know all five. Mm-hmm. You're just waiting to see which one will happen.
Yeah, right.
It's a bummer. I don't know how, because if they don't have the scripts and people are just seeing things being shot, you can surmise certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a real killer when you have the plot points and you can just like match up the scene to what they're shooting and have 90% of the stuff confirmed before like they're even done editing the damn thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, and also HBO, no fucking way would they try something that cool and cloak and daggery.
I mean, you're guaranteed not to get any direwolves if you do that.
How?
Because the budget won't be there. They'll be shooting right. All these fake fucking scenes.
All these B footage is just right. Never going to happen. Patrick Moss, with the HBO series nearly ended, speculation has mounted that Gurm will release the final books after the show finishes, if ever. If the series is ever completed, do you think it's possible that Amazon or Netflix or someone would pick up the series again due to popularity and almost guarantee of a lengthy, well-watched series? If a reboot ever happens, Aaron as a book reader, which plot points or storylines would you like to see included? And Jim as a show watcher, which plot points would you like to see removed? Do either of you think an animated series would be a good idea?
An animated series? No. No, this is not going to be Star Trek. Man.
Why don't people take animation seriously? I think that's a big weakness of in America.
Yeah.
That the fastest, cheapest, easiest way to do some of this shit is to do an animated series, but we perceive animated series as being a less serious form of entertainment for mm-hmm. no fucking good reason. Other than Walt Disney made a shit pile of money making movies about a mouse with big ears.
Yeah.
Like,
it's perceived as children's entertainment.
Right.
In America.
Pixar is starting to chip away at that, but it's still family sure. entertainment. It's not like something yeah. that adults just go and watch usually on their own. So I don't know. But I don't think it can be an animated series because people wouldn't take it seriously.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I can't, like, in 20 years, is a reboot going to be warranted? Because the budget would have to be even bigger, and would it look dated enough to warrant a reboot? I don't think so. Maybe
season
in like 40 years.
Dated, I will say.
It. Well, what do you mean dated? Like, I mean, it looks like the budget isn't as high. I would agree with that.
Okay,
but I don't think like film stock and cinematography looks dated. I think. Yeah. In the same way that, like, you go watch Fawlty Towers or something and it looks
okay,
fucking
it's not,
dated.
Sure, it's not that bad.
Yeah, so in, like, 40 years, I could see it. In 20, I think it'll still be too soon. Like, going back and doing The Matrix at this point would be stupid because it looks awesome.
Or Lord of the Rings. Or,
yeah.
I bet there's no fucking way that we're going to live out our lives and, like, Harry Potter not be remade.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think because everything gets remade. Everything is, like, even Star Wars is getting like, who would have thought 15 years ago or 20 years ago that they'd reboot essentially Star Wars and take start up right where, you know, I guess the us fans assumed they would start up all along.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know.
But that was, like, 40 years later, you
right?
know?
And the other thing is, I guess if there might be more steam behind this if there was a lot of differences between the Martin version and the show version, which my gut tells me that's if Martin finishes, they're going to hold very closely to. That they'll be as essentially as faithful as like the season 5-ish, you know, season 6-ish, where there was more right. liberties taken because the Double D's didn't know what the hell was going on. But like people that think that Stannis is going to live, like I just got a feedback this week. People think that Stannis is going to, you know, be the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch at the end of the story. Like I think you're fooling yourself. There's no way. Like people that live and people that die, people sitting in positions of power, the ultimate state of the board. I don't think those are going to be different.
Do reboots happen in literature, in books?
I mean, there's Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies.
Yeah, I guess. That's a weird reboot of that.
I don't think so, because books don't have those problems.
Right.
Like, there's not an adaptation of a book. Like, you can either continue the ideas, but it's not like the author's imagination needed to be upgraded.
Right.
You know, it's like,
maybe, like, sensibilities, perhaps?
But then...
Why tell that story again? Tell a different one.
And even then, the story's like, you know, it's like Huck Finn, mm-hmm. you know, Finn's modern sensibilities, but that's kind of the point. And
yeah.
it was like, you know, the fact that it was progressive for its time, and And you got to go with, like, you know, the Huck's attitude towards his friend Jim rather than the fact that he calls him N-bomb Jim.
Right.
Is the key thing about that. So, I don't think that's a thing. I don't think they reboot book series.
Hmm.
And now, plot points, like, I guess my biggest problem with what the Double D's did, and it's not even a problem with what they did, it's maybe a problem with the books and how sprawling thing Martin got. You either do Dorne right or not at all.
Yeah.
Like, in the books, Dorne is awesome because just when you think Prince Doran is this do-nothing, bumblefuck, gout-ridden invalid, he gives one of the most badass speeches and is like, you fools, me and Oberyn were working this to perfection. We've had this plot to put us back in power with the Targaryens and Essos and bring fire and blood. And it's like, fuck yeah, Doran. And here, like
none of that.
But
here.
Even then, I'm not sure because, like, I don't know. Now that I've seen it executed, I don't know how you can make the Sand Snakes a great idea.
Hmm.
I don't know for sure how that you can save, like, fucking Darkstar, who was not, like, even the Double D's didn't touch him with the 10-foot pole.
I don't even know who that is.
Right, right. it could be that Dorne's just bad and needed to be excised.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple things I'm going to point out in this season in particular. There's a couple things, the plot with Corran Halfhand, that I didn't think is as good as the books, and I didn't think there was any reason why it couldn't have been. That's all I talked about. I remember in the original podcast I did for season two. I'll talk about it as I go, but I don't have a lot of major criticisms for things that are left out because that's the thing. Adaptation is all about knowing what to cut and what to not because it takes a hell of a lot longer than 10 hours. To read these books.
Yeah.
So I've never been one that really talks a lot of shit about the Double D's. Even in recent season when I have, it's always couched in, but I don't know what they've got to work with. And I kind of pity the situation they're in.
Right.
Do you have any ideas of things you thought was stupid?
I mean, the Sand Snakes, yeah, they're a perfect example. But you're right. You sort of can't do anything with Dorne, without doing all of the stuff with Dorne, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if I would cut that.
Although, pause that thought because we had someone send in a really baller idea about how to bring Dorne back in with Jaime that we kind of dismissed last week.
Okay.
So that's coming up here. A final point, as podcasters would dropping the entire series in one day make a job. Job's difficult? Are you fucking kidding? It'd be impossible.
I mean, this is...
Are you talking about dropping
the entire series? Are you British? Are you British? Do you mean season? Or do you mean like 60, 70, 80 episodes?
Honestly,
of a show?
Dropping the entire Game of Thrones is such so dense, dropping a whole season would be murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like House of Cards wears me the fuck out. Mm-hmm. Daredevil wears me the fuck out. Game of Thrones? Like, it would be awesome for fans because you just binge the shit out of that. But for, like, it wouldn't work. We would have to come up with a schedule and we would be ahead of some people and behind some people and it'd be a shit show.
Yeah.
But yeah. DJ Hova, do you think if the show they made the show two seasons for each book and followed the book plots more closely that the show would still be as popular as it is today? I mean, that's like asking if the sun disappeared, how that would affect the Earth's orbit. Like, there is no way to answer that effectively because here's the thing: you're not going to have a live action TV show last 14 seasons in the modern time frame because. You know, Bran would be 30. They're already having problems in, like, The Walking Dead going into their ninth. Like, if the show is popular, these actors will be in demand, and they don't want to be nailed down to this fucking show. Like,
true.
7 to 8 seasons is about as long as you can go without having to make people leaving part of the plot, and you can't tell. I mean, that's why the golden age of television is in, like, the 3 to 5, occasionally 6 or 7, sweet spot, because that's how long you can nail people down for contracts and have it stick.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't think, like, and also I don't know that two seasons for Feast of Crows would be great. I don't know that two seasons for Dance of Dragons would be great. There's a lot of those ideas that are dead ends and I don't think are going to be relevant. They're red herrings or world building that visually you wouldn't hold. I mean, how do you do some of those chapters where it's like fucking Sansa riding down the mountainside for a whole chapter or Tyrion walking around wondering where whores go for chapter after chapter after chapter. Like, I don't know that works. Like,
yeah, I don't know enough
internal
about
monologues
books.
And travel and all that kind of stuff. Like, people bitch about jetpacking, but some of that stuff's good, and that's what successful adaptations are all about.
Yeah.
Chrisell, I think HBO has struck a deal with Martin to delay the series of the books until after the show is completed. I know a lot of people who love the books first and the show second. If they thought it was a possibility that the books would come out at any time soon, they wouldn't watch the show because they'd rather get the story from Martin. But the books aren't coming out for a long time or at all. They would be more than willing to watch the show. I think, number one, you underestimate how fucking livid Martin's publisher would be if they found out that he was sitting on this stuff to make HBO happy. There would be lawsuits likes which the creative world has never seen. And also, you very overestimate the book readers' resolve to not watch the show.
Also, you overestimate the number of book readers as well.
That's true.
Like, to hit New York Times bestseller, you're talking about 100, 200,000 people.
Yeah.
We're talking about how many millions of people watching this?
Yeah,
I mean, it wouldn't put a dent in the ratings.
I have no doubt that millions of people have owned and read these books, but 100 million people are watching the television series.
Yeah.
So I just don't think that I just don't think that, legally you can make that work. And also the fact that the book, like, legions of book readers swore that they would never watch the show back in season 5.
Ridiculous.
And yet the Song of Ice and Fire Reddit has quadrupled in size, and I don't see anybody that starts a thread and says, "Hey, just want to let you know that I'm still holding strong." Like, it's just
right.
That's not human nature. But look at the leaks. How many people read the leaks and spoilers knowing it's going to adversely affect their enjoyment of the show, but they can't fucking help themselves.
Yeah.
So, Rob, as unsatisfying as it would be, is there any possible way that Arya died back in Essos? And could this be Jack and Hagar, another faceless man, using Arya's face to kill the waif and beyond? No. I don't think so.
Is there any... Is it possible?
No, it's not.
It's possible. It's not plausible. It's not like... Yeah, I can't imagine, like, if they tried to pull that.
Yeah. It's just, think about how stupid you'll feel after you watched fake Arya fake reconcile with her fake sister and bond over their father. Like, not, I mean, like, it would just, like...
And why does the House of Black and White give a shit?
Right.
Why do they want to be in Westeros? Why do they want to go to Winterfell?
Might be a plot where the House of Black and White, like... There's a lot of theories to be had here. Like, is Arya actually serving the God of Death by doing all this killing? Is Jaqen kind of a radical? Like, is he going to come, or is there going to be faceless men that try to come after Arya for forsaking their ways? Like, I don't know,
right.
but being wholesale replaced, no fucking way.
If Arya dies in Essos, there's no need for them to come to Westeros.
Yeah, I just don't. I just don't. And he has a couple of evidence here about one of them was that. It explains the strange power plays with Sansa and Nymeria's reaction to her. Man, if that's not really Arya, Nymeria just rips her in half.
Yeah.
Like, the only way she walks away from that is because Nymeria remembered her and had some sort of affection for her.
Yeah.
So, like, I think that's evidence against, unless you think a direwolf can be fooled by the Faceless Men's magic. And now we're just, you know, just making shit up, so... So move on. Danielle V, I want to pose a question for you. We learned in episode 7 that Robert's rebellion was based on a lie. Does the book leave any breadcrumbs about who might have started the lie? Did Ned know that Lyanna actually wasn't kidnapped and raped? What about Varys? I'm not sure where he would have been at the time, but it seems like a narrative he would have pushed to ensure the Mad King would be overthrown. Not asking for fan fiction, I'm just curious, in the light of what we know, does any hints of the book stand out in hindsight?
So as someone who doesn't know if there might be details to clarify this, I've always kind of assumed that it was sort of a people's rumor. Like Cersei's trying to say, you know, about Joffrey's birth.
Yeah.
Or Joffrey's father.
I mean, there's lots of hints that the official story is not true. Like, for example, Ned's inner monologues. It's not like he thinks about... Rhaegar a lot, but the times his thoughts do touch on Rhaegar, it's not like that son of a bitch who kidnapped and raped my sister.
Yeah.
He always thinks of him as kind of like, you know, like in a sympathetic light, and that doesn't jibe with what we would think Ned would think if he thought his sister was brutalized by this man.
Yeah.
People respect, like Ser Barristan Selmy has a circumspect thought on their relationship. as he communicates it to Danny. And, you know, as we see a little bit of that in the show. And I think you're right. I think that Varys and Littlefinger probably know the score, but there's absolutely no telling Bobby B that he wasn't true blue for Lyanna. And she, I mean, you know, they're political creatures and they know, like, what would be the point of putting that out there with the king that they served. And also, we've never gotten a Varys or Littlefinger POV chapter. So I think some of this stuff in later seasons where Littlefinger's dropping hints, like, that might be stuff that we see happen in the books. But I already think there's enough evidence that a lot of thinking fans, I mean, this is one of the pillars of the R plus L equals J theory, is that why when Ned has a chance to think about Rhaegar in a situation, does he think of it in this light? Why does Barristan Selmy kind of like, hey, you know, not so fast about the... You know, that's one of the evidences that people put. So yeah, it's there, but it's not, you know, obviously Bran coming and saying it's all based on a lie,
right?
Which is kind of a half truth anyway. The Mad King was going to Mad King. It's just a matter of who called their banners over what odious provocation. So. Let's move on. Jason L., about halfway through your Season 7 wrap-up episode, you covered a listener question about Jaime's decision to leave King's Landing. In true bald move fashion, speculation and discussion about Jaime's motivations followed, and at one point a speculative question was thrown out about Jaime's past history with Dorne. While the question was quickly dismissed, it struck me as something that set my mind off regarding the Dornish plot in general and some rough ideas for Season 8. Jaime has become a leading battlefield general, but I don't know if I see Team Stark soldiers fighting for him. However, there's an untouched army hinted at in Season 7 from Dorne. The only show characters with any relation to Dorne plot are Jaime and Bronn and Varys, and I'm going to consolidate the rest of his points. Essentially,
Jaime goes and gets the army.
Well, right? One of the things that Bronn said in Season 1 is, like, when he's talking about the Eyrie and it's said to be impregnable, oh, give me 20 good men, I'll impregnate the bitch. There's never, like, Bronn has showed his qualities in many ways, but never that. A stronghold such as the Red Keep that is holding Alaria Sand, who is probably still alive next to the moldering corpse of her daughter. Like, what if Jaime sends Bronn to infiltrate, steal her, take her back to Dorne, and now you've got this fresh army to rally around this incredibly vengeance-seeking character now? That would be fucking rad. That's a great way to use their shared history with Dorne.
Talk about a shaky alliance. I mean, this woman did kill his daughter, right?
Yeah, but, like, I think Jaime's all in on this is the biggest fight of our time. Yeah. Like, I'm ready to make all bygones. Yeah, because this is our survival we're talking about. Everything else we can figure out later. I don't know.
Yeah, I could maybe see that.
It would be exciting as hell to see Bran break into the Red Keep and steal her. It'd be gratifying to see Ilaria lead all of Dorne against Cersei and get her revenge on her.
Yeah,
it makes a lot of sense. I hope this isn't some leaked that's come out in September of 2017 about something that's probably going to come out in 2019. But
right, I don't think the script has been written yet. So
no, probably. It has. It's been
not all of it. I thought they were just starting writing.
No, like, all the scripts have been handed in. They haven't broke them yet.
Oh fuck.
Okay. So either way, hell of a good idea, Jason. I like that a lot. Bryce B, did it ever occur to you guys that Cersei committed to helping Dany and Jon because Tyrion promised her that her newborn child would be the next in succession to sit the Iron Throne? In previous episodes, Tyrion tries...
But wait, then she says, hey, all of that stuff that I told Tyrion and Dany is bullshit and we're actually not going to do the thing we said we're going to do, therefore jeopardizing her son's future. Like...
Yeah.
No, she wasn't convinced. She was not convinced.
It makes Tyrion a traitor to Dany because he doesn't have the authority to... I mean, that Dany would burn him alive.
Yeah.
Rightfully so.
I mean, does he think Danny's going to lose this battle against the White Walkers?
He might. I don't think he does. I think he's true blue. I think if he's a traitor...
I mean, maybe he thinks with my help she might lose.
I think if he's a traitor, it's going to be a subconscious one. That he, like what people said about the fact that he just loves his family at the end of the day is straight on. And he... is unknowingly giving Danny advice that's not the thing that he would do if he was against a foe that he's completely dispassionate about.
Right.
I don't think that's likely.
But I don't know how far that love extends. Does it extend to Cersei? Because Jesus Christ, she's been an unholy bitch to him the entire the entirety of his life.
It certainly extends to Jaime.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. Like, if Jaime gets back to the North and him and Tyrion reconcile, then there's no fucking way that Tyrion's a spy. I think it's much more likely that Varys is trying to play both sides because he's genuinely and probably rightfully afraid of Dany, and he wants to make sure that he's got some form of power over her in case she goes Mad Queen.
Yeah.
But yeah, she.
I don't know. I just don't. I don't think that's what happened there.
Right. And that's just, yeah, it's like it doesn't seem to make sense from either angle. So sorry. I don't subscribe to that theory, Bryce. Eric, well, thematically, it makes a lot of sense that Jon will be Rhaegal's dragon rider. My question is whether it's actually a good strategy. Jon is a king of the North, arguably the best swordsman in Westeros and the owner of a Valyrian steel blade. Having him ride a dragon takes away these advantages. Assuming he does ride Rhaegal, I can see a Mission Impossible sequence where he jumps off Rhaegal in midair to take out the Night King and Viserion in a kamikaze fashion. That'd be kind of fucking badass. Also, Theon should have died on that beach. It would have been a fitting end to his arc. He fought to regain his honor and lost.
No, never. Tyrion will never die.
I think him dying would have been okay and if it then inspired his men to go back and do what's right by Asha. But knowing the Greyjoys like I do, I don't think it would have worked.
Yeah,
I really like last week how we got to an appreciation of his plot.
Did you say Theon?
Yeah, what'd you think?
Theon. I thought you said Tyrion.
Oh.
Yeah, Theon can die anytime. That's fine by me.
No, Theon.
I thought it was a good scene, but yeah.
What do you think about the Jon jumping off, like air-to-air dragon fighting?
Sure. Hopping from dragon to dragon.
This show's the ceiling for spectacle is like Empire State Building.
Yeah. I think you have him jump from one dragon to try and jump on the White Walker's dragon to take it out as a suicide mission. The White Walker dragon zooms out of the way. You get another dragon swooping under to catch Jon. It's just this essentially
Rube Goldberg dragon contraption.
Right. Jon's being bounced around like a pinball, dragon to dragon.
Alex F., I got an idea. The final scene, we pan out back and back and back through the cosmos, through the universe, until we see one giant blue eye, George R. Martin himself. Now, this is based on a quote from the first season, I think, where Rob says, talking about old Nan, one time she told me the sky is blue because we live inside the eye of a blue-eyed giant named McCumber. And then in season 4, Oberyn repeats that as a way to like, yeah, some people think we live in the blue eyeball of a giant. The problem with this is, number one, the balls it would take to do some kind of meta thing at the end. Like, Game of Thrones would have to have an immense well of fan love and an ironclad notion that they are ending this story in the best way possible to pull off something like that.
Yep.
Like suck a fucking Men in Black. Our universe is some marbles that some fucking aliens are playing. And the biggest problem is George R.R. Martin's not blue-eyed.
No?
I looked it up. I thought he was, but he actually has eyes as brown as the day is long.
Here's what you do. I've got your end scene that satisfies all those requirements.
Okay.
So you do, you have whatever conclusion it's going to come to happen, and then you skip ahead in time to the old man that is Sam, and he's writing the Game of Thrones story, the Song of Ice and Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then you zoom into his eye. And then you zoom back out, and it's George Martin, and he's reading as he's writing, and the voice morphs from Sam to George.
Mm-hmm.
The eye changes from blue to brown.
Yeah.
And then you pull out, and you see this fucking suspender wearing cap wielding guy, just writing furiously at a desk.
I like the idea.
Or finishing it and putting away his ink, his feather.
Yeah, no. I like the idea of George Martin in universe playing a maester that's an old version of Sam. Like I would like a dissolve from,
but
young
it's got
to
be in universe. Yeah,
like you could see Sam writing the prologue for a Game of Thrones about you know the Manderly boy.
Is that
going
a comment
into
on how long it's taken him to write it?
Yeah, and then it dissolves into him as an old maester, like putting the finishing touches on an epilogue of A Dream of Spring. I think that would I would. You know, I've got a lot of complex feelings about George Martin and his relationship to his fandom.
Right.
But I have a lot more affection. I got enough affection that would be fitting and cool.
As long as it's in universe.
But the problem with it is if he's not finished by that time, like it's just going to seem like it's mockery.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to happen. It's a damn shame. It's a damn shame, but that because I think that'd be cool, pretty cool. Isadora, I refuse to believe that Numerian Ghost will fade into SFX Oblivion for Season 8. Established at the beginning of the series and steeped in Stark lore, they make the perfect secret weapons for both Jon and Arya as they face the Night's King. Catelyn highlights their importance to Robb in A Storm of Swords. I think perhaps the gods sent them to us. Your father's gods, the old gods of the North. What do you think their end role will be?
I don't think we're going to see Numeria again.
Man, I
think Numeria's out.
It would be such spectacle to see some kind of giant wolf army led by Direwolf doing...
Yeah.
Doing. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just like Cersei's trying to escape from the King's Landing in advance of the invading hordes, and she's through to Riverlands, and Nymeria's pack falls upon her. Like, that would be kind of cool. But that's
that
no...
Cool, yeah.
Those are no hands around a pale throat, neither.
Right, yeah.
So that falls afoul of the Valonqar prophecy, yeah.
But I think we could see Ghost again. I think we probably will see Ghost again.
There's no fucking way we don't see Ghost again.
Yeah, and I think Ghost will be important in helping Jon. Like,
because if Ghost is going to die, then they should have gone with the Ghost as a refrigerator theory, where Jon's soul spends a couple episodes in Ghost's body, and then when he comes back, Ghost gives his soul back, and that kills Ghost somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't see Ghost again, that will be pretty fucking unsatisfying. I don't know what Ghost would do against the Army of the Dead, though. I mean, Summer was pretty badass, but even he could, you know, got overrun by a few.
Yeah.
So maybe Direwolf teeth are like obsidian to White Walkers.
He's going to give him an obsidian grill.
That's cool.
Uh-huh.
That would be cool. Like a Valyrian steel muzzle that has like swords or daggers or some shit coming out of it. It's like now I'm seeing like a Valyrian steel dog cone. Like you put after you get your dog fixed or something.
Yep.
All right, moving on. Tyler M., I just had a thought. What if the Valonqar prophecy that says little brother actually alludes to the second sons? A second son would be by default be a little brother, so maybe the prophecy actually points to Daario choking out Cersei after flipping from the Golden Company. It may not be the best take, but it would fulfill the prophecy. You know?
Second son, interesting.
Yeah, no, like Daario used to be a leading contender for because he doesn't have much relevance to Cersei, but he does have the fact that he's literally... You know, this shadowy character from an outfit called the Second Sons. There might be
also
little...
the second actor to portray that character.
I mean, there is a little bit of pure Valencia, Valonqarcia juice to be squeezed from him. But I something I was surprised that Kim is a big person in favor of Daario coming back heading the Golden Company to do. But I mean, because to me, if he loves Dany, he's going to sit there and do what she commanded him to do. If he doesn't love Dany, then he's going to eventually get bored and fuck off.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then him riding at the head of the Golden Company, he wouldn't be fighting for Dany. He'd be fighting against her. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of that theory. And that's okay.
I mean, unless you combine that with the idea that Cersei's going to get the Golden Company only to be betrayed by them.
I mean, I do think that will happen.
Yeah.
But the Golden Company are not Second Sons, so then you've lost the pure Valencia.
But it's led by the Second Son,
the Second
Daario.
Son of Daario.
Yeah,
I don't see what narrative like. And also, this is a bias you need to be aware of. Characters I don't like, I have blind spots to. Like I was the one saying, no fucking way, Euron's going to come back. There's no fucking way the Greyjoy plots are going to come back. And I've been binging. Not that I didn't like binging. I just didn't think it's going anywhere. So, like, I have a bias towards not seeing the things I don't want to see. So I could very easily be wrong. But all I can do is tell you my opinion and give you enough information about biases. You can tell whether I'm full of shit or not.
Yeah.
And that's a podcast for the week, Jim.
Cool. That's fun.
We will be back again for our combined episode rewatch and spoiler podcast next week when we consider the second episode of the second season, which is called, I'm not even sure.
That's not what it's called.
It's not important because we'll have the title ready for to go when we come back.
We will. You will know it in the first opening seconds.
Yeah. So look forward to seeing you there. Of course, you can send in feedback at GameOfThrones@BaldMove.com or go on forums.baldmove.com if you want to see what your fellow fans have to say about the episode and their rewatch and Game of Thrones in general. And we will see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.